Morning!
Morning!
Welcome to the India Explained podcast, recorded in London and San Francisco. One take, unscripted, no rehearsal. Hey Bunty, greetings from San Francisco. What's up with you?
Everything's cool, Rohit. Everything's cool. It's nice and chilled in London. We are having a relaxed weekend. So all is good. And the other later on today, I'm going to meet some friends of mine who have also originally grew up in India, but make up this part of the world now, live in this part of the world now. A diaspora is one term that is used, but it's an old school way of saying NRI, non-resident Indian. And that's something that we wanted to talk about for a long time. So I think...
Right.
It'll be good. This is a good opportunity as any to talk about that. So where you guys are based in San Francisco, what's the Indian diaspora like? Or is it labeled South Asian? What goes on?
It is labeled South Asian. And, you know, I have my own ambivalence about that term. That's actually the, you know, kosher term, the term that's preferred by liberals or people who espouse progressive values. And the term, you know, Indian or Indian subcontinent has now sort of retroactively or by implication been, it's associated with people who are supposed to be on the conservative end of the political spectrum. That said, I have my own reservations about the term because I think South Asia is an area studies term. It comes out of a particular American academic context, and it's to use that academic language, become hegemonic in itself. But that, pardon the digression, San Francisco doesn't have a huge Indian population. In the Bay Area, generally, there are some towns which are super Indian heavy, like Fremont and Sunnyvale, San Jose, Santa Clara, to a lesser extent. So there's a road that runs, you know, all the way through these Silicon Valley towns, and you'll find on maybe a 3 or 4 kilometer stretch, something like maybe, you know, 10 different Indian stores, 5 Indian shops selling saris, 7 or 10 different kinds of restaurants, sub-specialized restaurants, chaat, food from different parts of India, and so on. And you know, these are also the parts of the Bay Area which are, I'd say, you know, which display some of those Indian pathologies that we grew up with. Obsessive competitiveness, you know, parents sending their kids to 5 kinds of tuitions, everyone dreaming about or wanting their child to be the next Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg, or, you know, be some kind of robotics expert, spelling bee champions, aspiring spelling bee champions, and so on and so forth. And of course, in terms of politics, lots of expertise, lots of gyan.
I think in London, it's slightly different. We have a very large section of the population. No, look, when I say large section of the population, I'm not going to lean on any kind of official statistics, but there are certain bits of London which have quite a lot of people from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. That's the kind of rough combination. And that is primarily informed by immigration and, you know, the history of the colonial relationship and the impact of that. But yes, there is a difference between people who have come here in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and a second wave of migration which happened in the 70s, predominantly East African Asians, Gujaratis from East Africa, who were expelled by Idi Amin. And then the latter stages, through the late 90s and the early 2000s, there has been an immigration of the kind of the frontline white collar IT professional services wave, which is so you see that. And I think one of the things, so if you forget about the people, the non-resident Indians who, actually, I don't even think they consider themselves non-resident Indians. The people who consider themselves non-resident Indians are predominantly the people who have grown up in the India of the 70s, 80s, 90s and have emigrated to be based out of Europe and find themselves in the UK. There's a significant population there. And I think the signs that you picked up, which is kind of ultra competitiveness amongst each other, you know, kind of bordering on envy or fueled by envy, being pushy about children and children's schooling, and generally sticking to their own, you know, as it not socializing broadly, are some of the classic signs, and it's a funny one. It's a funny one, because I think these people, whenever they get together, they're always getting together and bitching about what are the things that are wrong with India.
Right.
That is the first half of the conversation. And the second half of the conversation is, wouldn't it be lovely if you could be settled in India?
Right.
Because life here is so difficult. You know, you do not know what life. So inevitably, whenever you're drawn into these kind of diaspora gatherings, it splits 50-50. The first half of the conversation is going to be that everything in India is wrong. You know, planes aren't on time. Everybody's out to scam you. There's this kind of ego operating, which I have never, you know, in part, I'm sometimes culpable around it. So I get frustrated when I visit India, but on certain occasions. But that's, you know, out of 10 interactions, 2 will go wrong. And that's par for course in any part of the world. You know, if I were traveling in America, if I was traveling in Japan, I would expect no less, no more. But I wouldn't use that to damn the whole country.
Right.
But I found that people, you know, Indigo flight was 3 hours late. You know, how does that matter, man? You know, and therefore, if your Indigo connection was 3 hours late, how is that a testament of India as a failing state?
Right.
You know, those kind of, so you get a bit of that. And then once the drinks have kicked in, it's all about, you know, there is nobody to make me, you know, paneer pakoda when I come home.
Yeah, you're spot on about this.
So this kind of lowness happens. But what I have never understood is this deep unease that people from India have with each other in another part of the world. And here's what I'm trying to say, Rohit. If you see an English person, or a person who's grown up in England, go to another part of the world, and they spot another person across an airport foyer or anything, the first instinct is, you know, where are you from? I'm from Liverpool. I'm from Scunthorpe. Whatever it is, there's a kind of a gentle politeness. It's a very odd thing when you see two Indians in a foreign land, because the first instinct is to scope out each other and see. It's an adversarial instinct. As opposed to like, you know, we belong together, let's stick together and do something interesting, or, you know, or let's at least be courteous. The first instinct is adversarial, right? Tu kahan se? You know, it is not, and the tu kahan se is not a friendly call. It's like, you know, I don't know what it is, but maybe you can throw some light on this.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you completely. I mean, the first, you know, I'm going to start with the last point you make. I think that's, It's a general Indian phenomenon, but I think it gets exacerbated in a different setting, because typically what happens in India is that you meet people who belong to the same bubble as you do, right? So if I, you know, went to a certain college, or I live in a certain part of the world, or I work in a certain industry, I know that the people I meet are likely for the most part to belong to the same kind of profile, broadly speaking, right? So this information is already given to me. And in India, you know, the signs and the codes are very easy to read, right? And there are these very elaborate social codes about how you interact with, you know, superiors, people who are lower than you in different kinds of social hierarchies, caste, class, occupation, accent, whatever. Now, when you're in a setting outside that, none of those, you know, markers seem to apply. So the first thing that happens is that people want to scope each other out so that they know where they stand in relation to each other, which will then dictate a series of behaviors. And then a lot of other stuff comes into play. You know, you might have some people who have more economic capital, but other people who have more cultural capital. I mean, I've seen this with people who come from well-educated backgrounds, but they encounter someone who, you know, doesn't have the same quote-unquote sort of markers of class, but has a lot of money. So then they pull class rank, you know, about accent and this and that. Also, there's a Indian habit I find annoying, which is that the moment you meet someone, which college did you go to? Where did you live? And if you say, I went to this college, or I, you know, worked here, or I went to this school, do you know this one? Do you know that one? And what started happening now is that because the Indian educated middle class slash elite, whatever you want to call it, is a fairly small world, and, you know, they're separated by 3 or 4 degrees of separation. Even if I know people, I just say, no, I actually don't know this person, because I really find it very tedious. And now, coming to your other points, you know, I think there's a lot of history and there is a lot of bad history, so to speak, at work in many of these encounters. As far as the point about, you know, holding forth, I would say that I don't exempt myself or any other NRI from it. I'm sure that, you know, these things apply to me as much as they do to other people. With regard to the Indians who emigrated who were forced to emigrate from Gujarat, I found that I've had a couple of unpleasant encounters with them. That I remember meeting this person who was, he was drunk, and I think he had, was someone who had been forced into exile, very hostile towards any Indian who had come from India. And I don't know what his, you know, identity was. What was it he was so upset about? Whether, you know, he had not been welcomed by other Indians, whether his family had migrated, you know, under different circumstances. So there was, you know, some like very weird stuff going on there. As far as that generation of Indians that left India in the 60s and 70s, I wonder if the racism that they had to encounter was much more acute than the racism that later generations had to encounter. And that's where the ambivalence comes in, that in some ways they feel angry. True. You know, because I actually have a, we have a family friend, someone who's my mother's friend. They settled in Britain, and that's exactly the profile, that they moved in the 60s, and they moved because India was very, very hard for them. So they, but, you know, they never really felt at home in Britain. So when I met them, the evening started with literally this, that, you know, the gentleman essentially talking about how awful India was. And the night ended with him telling me how much he missed India and how isolated he was and how isolated his children were and so on and so forth. So, you know, maybe it's become easier now. Or maybe there's also more guilt that that generation carries, because in the Nehruvian era, to leave the country was to betray it, right? Being a good citizen meant that you stayed and worked for the progress of the nation.
Right. I think you make some very interesting points, Rohit. I hadn't honestly seen it. That kind of race angle had completely missed. I put it to one side, but you're so right in calling that out. And, you know, that's the generation that, you know, we probably will not either understand or should fairly try and speak about. But I think as you slip to the people who came towards the late 90s, mid 90s, and then the early 2000s, I think that's a very unique brand of Indians who've come. And I think where the fault line lies is with, there's a diaspora. And by this, I mean people who have been second generation, who've grown up here, who've been educated here. And by here, I mean, in my case, it's in the United Kingdom. In your case, it's the United States. Somehow they feel that they have had it good. Also, the narrative that their parents have pushed on them is, look, I grew up in India. I came to this foreign land to make a better life for myself. And you are getting the benefits of that better life, as in a great education, great opportunities, etc. So that's their framing of it, right? Roll it up to their working life. So they do all of the things that they have to do and enter into a job. And lo and behold, there's this other guy from Bangalore who comes and joins them in the same office, in the same role, who's clearly off that ethnic origin, of Indian origin, and that sets off panic bells, because, you know, in the narrative of this person who has grown up in this country, they are better because they have gone through a system which is better, more equitable, fairer, and he or she's always thought that they'd naturally be
right
somewhere ahead in the order of things. So when they meet somebody from base or mothership who can speak as well, think as well, act as well, that's where an odd kind of disconnect happens. Exactly. I think as we grow up together as different people from different walks of life, but all of us Indians, I think this kind of issue of social confidence will kind of fall away. Right. And I hope that people will be able to generally drop their kind of NRI ego, as I call it, and just be more chilled out. And obviously, every time I run into a person who gives me long ones about, you know, how rubbish the drains were or how slow the cabs were, I have no time for them anymore, because I think that, you know, they are doing themselves a disservice and the country that has moved on a massive disservice as well.
Right. Bunty, let's wrap this up here. You know, what we'll do is we'll pick up part two in a little bit, okay? All right, take care, man.
Okay. Bye. Chalo, take care. Bye-bye.